So it's a great pleasure to welcome Rupert Sheldrake. He's spoken on our program many, many times over the years. Eminent biologist with a keen interest in spirituality, author of many, many books, and he's joined by Mark Vernon, who's a writer and a psychotherapist. And he and Mark have been having a dialogue for about 7 years now, and these are on Rupert's website, freely available. But this is the first time we've hosted them both here together, so please do give a very warm welcome to Rupert Sheldrake and Mark Vernon.
Thank you. Well, thank you. It's very good to be here again. This feels like being at home, really. I've been speaking here for many, many years. But it's the first time that I've talked in public with Mark Vernon, who's a friend and a colleague. And we've been conducting a series of dialogues, more than 50 of them, which are online and which cover a whole range of topics like pilgrimage, subtle bodies, secular Buddhism, a few more.
Pilgrimage. Oh, you said that.
Yes.
How to pray, belief in angels. Eco-confessions, that was the latest.
The latest one. But we've never done this in public before, so this is a new experiment. And one reason why we're doing this now is that Mark's book, A Secret History of Christianity, Jesus, the Last Inkling and the Evolution of Consciousness, has recently been published. And also, my own book, Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work, came out in paperback 2 or 3 days ago. So both of them are really about the evolution of consciousness. And that's one of the subjects, the main subject we're talking about this evening. And I'm going to ask Mark if he can tell us something about this view that he's been developing based on the work of Owen Barfield, who some of you may have heard of and some may not. But one of the great prophetic thinkers in Britain in the last few decades. So, Mark.
Thank you very much, Rupert. You did actually, when I showed you the book, first of all, you did say, oh, it's brief too, as well as a secret. And you said, what a blessing that is, given it's a quick trip through Christianity. I just want to take the moment, actually, just to pay tribute to Rupert, who I guess everyone in the room will know. I can remember first reading Rupert's books and not just being interested in what he had to say, but something about the spirit of the way that he said it, which was fearless. And that was quite a liberation for me. So then when a few years later we met and then we decided to do these dialogues and so on, it's a very important part of my spiritual development, you might say. So it's very nice publicly to be able to pay tribute to what you do, Rupert. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Mark.
So I discovered this chap, Owen Barfield. And again, it was another quite a sort of revelatory moment, really. I have a bit of a history with Christianity, which hasn't always been comfortable. And he helped situate that and what's going on, particularly in the West, now in the past, and also looking towards the future unfolding as well. And so it's to give you some sense of that. I hope that we'll be able to do that in the first period, and then we'll develop it between ourselves, and then, of course, have questions at the end too, which would be great, because that always develops things even better. Barfield was the key influence behind both C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. And they both, in their different ways, said Barfield had all the best ideas. And there's a story that one time when Tolkien came back from a lecture in Oxford, he said he spent the whole lecture realizing he couldn't say what he was about to say because Owen Barfield had said something to him the night before. And so it really helped both Tolkien and Lewis develop their ideas. Barfield himself was a philologist like Tolkien and Lewis and many of the other Inklings. They belonged to this Oxford group, the Inklings, meeting and discussing their ideas. And he got it from his study of words. And a little illustration as to how he came up with his idea that consciousness evolves, spirituality evolves. Because he did it, first of all, with a kind of empirical base. It wasn't just the sense that he had or a kind of intuition that came to him and he developed. he noticed that words, almost invariably, actually, he said, and over the years, people tried to challenge him and found counterexamples, and no one really ever could. They tend to begin, say, about 3,000 years ago, which is about the earliest you can track the history of words in written documents. They tend to begin with both an inner meaning and an outer meaning. And then that gradually shifts, and very often the inner and the outer become alienated from one another. And then that produces a kind of struggle to regain meaning in the periods of alienation. So just one very brief example is the word pneuma in Greek, ruach in Hebrew, and I believe that you can track the same in other languages as well. That if you, for example, will even read the New Testament, so about 2,000 years old, the word pneuma there means simultaneously wind, breath, and spirit. And it's only now, for example, when you try and translate the New Testament Greek and come across the word pneuma, you have to decide which one you're going to choose. So if you're familiar with the New Testament at all, you'll know the expression, the wind blows where it wills, that's the way of the Spirit. It says a bit more than that, but that's broadly the kind of the notion. And you'll notice there that wind has become a metaphor for Spirit. The wind blows where it wills, and that's the way of the Spirit. Whereas Barfield said originally, the word wind and spirit, the pneuma blows where it wills, that's the way of the pneuma. The implication is that the experience when that text was written has dramatically changed. Our experience has dramatically changed from the original experience. And he used the word participation to capture this shift of experience. Participation really just meaning how you experience life, how you're embedded in life. And he thought that these words can be used as what he called fossils of consciousness to try and recover an older experience of life, an older participation, an older consciousness in that sense. And from that, try and derive some meaning for how it's changed and why it's changed and what that means now and what that might mean in the future. And broadly speaking, he felt that ancient people, and again, sort of before the Christian period in particular, had experienced life really not as a problem of meaning, so even to the point now where it's quite natural to ask, is there a meaning to life? Rather, the experience of life was of being thrown into a kind of flood of meaning, and the challenge was how to negotiate that through, say, your practices in relation to the gods, through the myths that you told, through the heroes or the deities that you particularly aspired to. So for example, if you read something like Homer's Iliad, you'll know that Achilles' problem, for example, is not, might my death mean, is there a point to fighting and dying? His question really is, how can I die so heroically that the gods notice me and turn me into a deity? A very different aspiration. As I say, whereas now, it's very natural for us, particularly in the 20th century, to even wonder whether there's a meaning at all. And Barfield felt that it's not just a kind of loss and a crisis, though, that this is about, but that our consciousness, our spirituality, is very much to evolve through periods of alienation in order to recover a new kind of sense of things. And to kind of cut to the chase, the reason why he thought that, as it were, spirituality works that way is because our almost invitation as human beings is to become more and more conscious of this flow of meaning. My pussycats at home, for example, I don't think they worried whether there was a meaning to life. They had a pretty good life, actually, and it was meaningful, I hope, in a pussycat kind of way. But whereas we human beings, we have that side of us too, but it seems like that we can be sure at least that we, maybe other creatures too, but certainly we, have a different challenge, which is not just to experience life, but is to experience it more and more consciously, self-consciously. And he felt that happens through periods of alienation. The descent, you might say, is as important as the ascent. And in particular, what happens during the dissent or the alienation, the crisis, is that you're forced to fall back on yourself. And that helps cultivate inner meaning. It helps cultivate things like free will, conscience, self-awareness, that can then reconnect with the meaning that's around us. But in a way, it means that we can become kind of co-workers or participants in a new way with the meaning that's all around us. He thought that this goes in sort of cycles over about maybe sort of 1,000, 1,500 years, something like that. We are now in the middle of one of the sort of descents, one of the alienating times, which is why he got onto it, because he felt it has a lot to tell us about how to navigate the now and then move into the future as well. That was broadly something to do with Barfield's idea.
I see. Can you say a little bit more about the it's called the secret history of Christianity. What's it does? Is it particularly Christ that has a key role in this model of his interpretation? And if so, how does that relate to this meaning and original participation or connection or alienation?
Yeah. So he thought that you could track an unfolding that was broadly a kind of alienation through both the Hebrew tradition from about 400-500 years before Christ, and in fact the Greek tradition as well. So, you know, when Socrates appears in ancient Athens and starts saying, "You think you know what friendship is, but what is it? You think you know what courage is, but what is it?" That throws people, as it were, back on themselves, and they rapidly realize they can't articulate very well what these things are, which is not so surprising because they'd use a different kind of consciousness before to live in those sort of domains, the consciousness that's particularly shaped by myth. But Barfield felt that, so this had been kind of unraveling in the Hebrew tradition as well, and that what it had allowed was an increasing sense of gatheredness in individual people. The individual, in a way you might say, was born in a way that you or I might understand it, which is why, for example, we sort of feel that somehow philosophy began with figures like Socrates. It didn't, of course, but it was just so different before that it becomes familiar around this time. And what that allowed particularly in this first phase was a sense that maybe reality itself had a kind of unity, had a kind of individuality, had an integrity that allowed a human awareness to move beyond the older dispensation around polytheism, which is much more natural in the older consciousness, to this sense that somehow my individuality might mirror or reflect or at least allow me to see, to participate in the divine individuality. So monotheism is the kind of upshot. You have to be able to experience a sort of gathered sense of self, you might say, to even have the perception that there might be a gathered divinity behind it all. And that the significance of Jesus, particularly around the Mediterranean, was that he was a person who people felt had lived both fully human, a fully human life, you know, even to the point of dying and so on, but also one that was completely transparent to the divine. So, as it were, his I am could mirror the old Jewish intuition that somehow God was I am as well. So this launched the new dispensation, and he argued this is why Christianity became so significant. It wasn't the only new religion, as it were, going on at the time, but it captured the shift of consciousness particularly. And, you know, either in the life of Jesus himself, I'm quite prepared to believe that, but certainly in the reflections that then came upon this figure, people were able to develop this consciousness for themselves. So someone like St. Paul would say, "I'm taking on the mind of Christ," for example. And then the individual becomes really, really important. And you get things like free will or conscience being talked about properly for the first time. They don't really exist before. So that's something about the significance of Christianity in its inception.
But this emphasis on the individual, I mean, it doesn't, in the Middle Ages, it wasn't terribly strongly developed. It obviously got a lot more developed through the Renaissance and especially through the Enlightenment. And it's a key feature of the modern world. So would you say that all of this, even sort of enlightenment, atheism, secular humanism, actually have their roots in this this sense that Christ had of the individual?
Yeah, for sure. So I think what he felt was that the first big phase of Christianity, I mean, he was open to what would happen to Christianity next, but certainly the kind of medieval full flourishing of Christianity, it developed sort of broadly in two ways. One was in terms of the mysticism of Christianity, so that figures like Meister Eckhart, for example, could say things like, you know, my sight and God's sight is one sight and one love and one knowledge and so on. That a very close identification with the monotheistic God. He felt that in society, the way that it plays out particularly was that the old identifications with, say, place or with kin become much looser, and it becomes possible to organize society around belief, essentially, or certainly commitments to a certain religion. It hadn't really worked like that before in a polytheistic world. And so Christendom, for example, arises. So that was the sort of more manifest or social aspect of that development. But it has its limitations and its internal contradictions and all the rest of it, which, you know, perhaps people will be familiar with. And so it falls into crisis. That is part of what we now think of, well, certainly the Reformation was the explicitly religious bit, but the Enlightenment and then the Scientific Revolution follow on from that, because what it allows is another deepening sense of the sovereignty of the individual, which then feeds into, you know, secular humanism and even the sort of the particularities of modern science and the way they differ from more ancient ways of doing science.
And how do you think it differs from other religions? I mean, in Buddhism, for example, there's the idea that the Buddha opens a way to enlightenment that others, humans, can participate in. In Theravada Buddhism, it's not about transforming the world, though. It's like undergoing a vertical takeoff and leaving behind this world of endless suffering and cycles, pointless cycles. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's still the idea that you leave behind the world we know, but you come back until the bodhisattvas come back to liberate all sentient beings, till everyone can undergo a vertical takeoff and leave this sorry world behind. Now, that's a very different view from the one, I mean, there's total alienation in the modern world, separation from nature, separation from God, complete alienation. How do you see the way in which things can be brought together again, differing between these traditions?
Yeah, I mean, he on the sort of the history bit, he felt actually that certainly Hindu traditions had quite a different interpretation after this sort of sense of individuality particularly formed. So for example, the Bhagavad Gita, which is pre-Christian probably in its origins, was completely reinterpreted as about the 3rd and 4th century AD, as we put it, and giving rise, for example, to Advaita Vedanta, which gives rise to the notion that the individual could, as you say, achieve vertical takeoff. So that he felt that that was, in a way, Christianity's genius is not an exclusive, you know, only through Christ can you be saved idea, much more that it seeds something that then becomes quite pervasive through other religious traditions, much as, you know, Western traditions, I think, are very profoundly influenced by Eastern traditions through ancient philosophy particularly. So that was something about how it relates in history. I think now he thought that actually, well, the one I should perhaps just say slightly in parenthesis is that Barfield was also very influenced by Rudolf Steiner, and in fact became quite a powerful advocate of anthroposophy. He has the great advantage, if I may say so, of being a really good read in a way that a lot of anthroposophical texts I find anyway quite tricky. So he was partly an introduction to that for me as well. But much like in Steiner's thought, I think he felt that part of the future, certainly at a kind of collective level, is that the West would contribute something and then the East would contribute something. And in particular, he thought that what Christianity and Western religion in more general needs to really come to terms with is the meaning of reincarnation. and that what the West is offering the East is not escape, as it were, from the material world, but rather, as the Christian world would put it, the remaking of the material world, so that there'd be some sort of synthesis of the two. So that was the sort of Western contribution to the future that would have to engage with the Eastern contribution. It's never with Barfield just a kind of addition. So as well, we'd all start believing in reincarnation and believe that somehow there'd be a new heaven and a new earth. But rather that the two would intertwine, and something that we can't quite yet conceive would be the result of that. But that's part of the discovery, that's part of the evolution. You know, an evolution is not just an extension of what you know, it's a complete transformation, so that something new is born that incorporates what was old, but is seen in a completely different light. And that's very much, that's why there's a process of struggle and alienation you have to go through as well. It's not just sort of, as we're plain sailing into the future.
Well, I think there's this theme of evolutionary interaction of these different traditions is, it couldn't be more important. In fact, it's one of the things that underlies this whole alternatives program. And it's one of the themes of my book, Ways to Go Beyond, because we now have access to spiritual practices from all the world's traditions. I mean, shamanic drumming, you know, from Siberia, ayahuasca ceremonies from Peru and Brazil. We have, you know, Sufi centers in London. We've got every mystical tradition, Hindu teachings, Tibetan Buddhist. All of these were shut up in separate compartments before. And now they're all available in London and in every major city in the world. And they're interacting with each other. There's an evolutionary interaction going on. And they're also now, more recently, interacting with science, because the scientific study of spiritual and religious practices is now, there are thousands of papers in journals. There's now a lot going on. And what these scientific studies show is that the practice of religious and spiritual practices make people happier, healthier, and live longer in general. I.e., the opposite must also be true, that having no spiritual or religious practices will make people unhappier, unhealthier, and live shorter. So I think that meditation has had a great many studies, the effects of prayer on the people who pray, many studies showing greatly beneficial effects. Physiological practices like fasting are common to all traditions, and now we know a lot more scientifically about how fasting affects neurotransmitters in the brain and has psychoactive effects. We know about the effects of singing and chanting. My wife, Jill Peirce, who's been teaching singing and chanting for many years, I've seen it many times through her workshops, how groups of people through chanting together form a much closer bond and end up feeling much happier and more connected. All religions have included these practices, but they're now all available and coming together. And I don't know whether Barfield had anything to say about this phase of where things will go in the future. He charts the separation from the sense of, I think he calls, original participation, of being interconnected with nature and everything else, to the separation and alienation that you've described. But then this reintegration process, how does he have anything specific to say about where it might go and how it might work?
Yeah, I think there was a very nice example, I think, which emerged from your book, which was about how the Trinity can be reinterpreted. So you might say that a medieval notion of the Christian idea that God is triune is fairly hierarchical. There's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and in particular, the Holy Spirit often struggles to get a sort of look in. But because of particularly the impact of Indian ideas, you reinterpret it as being consciousness and bliss, and then make the extra step of showing how spiritual practices can be seen as picking up on these different themes. So that felt to me like a good example as how something is in the process of evolving, and who knows quite where that might end up.